we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here on this edition of the program. The show is hosted each week by Rick Green and myself. We rotate each week. Rick's with you on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I'm with you on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And we enjoy hosting the program, and we appreciate all of our listening audience out there. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, we would love for you to do so. You can simply type in the name of the show, At the Core, and click the subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Google Play, Spotify, all the various podcast stores or platforms. You can type the name of the show, and we're there, and you can click the subscribe button. Psalm 150 is where we are this week. Psalm 150. If you've ever heard the song, there's probably multiple, but the song, Let Everything That Has Breath Praise the Lord. If you've ever heard those lyrics, well, that's directly out of Psalm 150, which is where we are this week. Verse 6, Let everything that has breath praise the Lord, praise the Lord. This psalm's a rather short one, only six verses, and the sixth verse is everything that has breath praise the Lord. That's our scripture for the week, Psalm 150, verse 6. Well, this is our Culture Warrior Emphasis Week. We're going to be having on M.D. Perkins later in the week to talk about this excellent film, this excellent documentary. But I just want to remind you, if you're watching online on Facebook or on our stream platform, you can see the DVD cover here. But you can watch this film for free at culturewarrior.movie, culturewarrior.movie. And I don't have time to go in depth on the details of the film and the movie, but it's excellent. It tells a little bit about the history of AFA, but it also talks about the broader culture war that we find ourselves in today. So go over to culturewarrior.movie and watch that film for free, and listen to AFR all this week for excellent interviews and content surrounding Culture Warrior. Well, Riley's in with us, Riley with a W, and that's my sister. She's director of the AFA Foundation, and she's been the director of the foundation for, Riley, correct me if I'm wrong, but over a decade.
Over a decade.
Yes, sir. Over a decade. And that's a little risky when I start throwing out, trying to do math,
math
on the fly.
Math and numbers, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, you've been the director of the foundation for some time now. And you guys offer a couple of different products, if you will. One of the most well-known is a charitable gift annuity, otherwise known as a CGA. Anybody who is near retirement or has broached the topic of retirement has probably come across the term charitable gift annuity, or simply annuity. Some people describe it differently. But Riley, before we talk about maybe some of the other ways to benefit American Family Association in folks' life planning and their financial planning, talk a little bit about the CGA product.
Yes, yes. So thank you again, Walker, for having me on this afternoon. But yes, the charitable gift annuity, like you mentioned, known as the CGA, is just basically a way you can give a gift to American Family Association, and in return, the donor or the annuitant can receive permanent income coming back to them for the rest of their life. So how that works is the minimum amount to fund the charitable gift annuity is $2,000. Or anything above that that you can give to American Family Association, and you can set that up what we call a one life, single life, or a joint life. So you can have only up to two people on the charitable gift annuity to fund the charitable gift annuity. So like I said, the minimum amount is $2,000. It can be a single life or a joint life. They give a gift to the American Family Association, like I said, receive an income for life, and when they pass away, anything left over is a gift back to American Family Association. So AFA is a beneficiary of the final gift, so to speak.
So this is an agreement between the annuitant or the donor,
correct,
and AFA, correct?
That is correct.
That they enter into.
Yes, sir.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I know just enough to be dangerous about how this process works, but that's why we have you guys. The longer you defer, the benefit,
yes.
The payments, typically the higher the amount, correct?
That is correct. So, for example, if somebody, let's just say, wanted to fund the charitable giving, they're single, they're 45 years old, and they call me tomorrow and say, hey, I would like to set up a charitable gift annuity for $5,000. Then, like you said, Walker, they can defer the income to reach, let's just say, 65 or 70 at retirement age and receive basically the like you mentioned, the rate of return is higher than if they started receiving at age 45.
Okay. So, let me ask you this. I know with some retirement accounts, there's, or if not all, there's required minimum distribution age, which is where you basically have to start drawing on it. With charitable gift annuities, can folks kind of push this out as long as they want? Or is there some kind of federal rule on when you have to begin drawing on the annuity?
That's a great question. So you can start receiving the income off of that at any time. So like I mentioned that example for 45, if they called in what we call a flexible deferred and they say, hey, you know, I'm 45 years old, I'm going to wait to receive the income at 65. Well, they don't have to receive the income, Walker, at 65. We can set it up anywhere between 60 and 70, for example. Okay. And we call that a flexible deferred gift annuity,
so
which we do
just,
that a lot.
They would just give you like a window of time.
Correct. About a 10-year, 5-year period.
Yeah. I think I want to take it during this time window.
Yes.
But they don't have to hard commit.
Correct.
Is what you're saying, until they get to that point.
Until they get to that point, until they get to age 60, and it, once they turn 60 years old, they say, hey, I don't need that income now. I'll wait another year. And so we normally do them in between a 5-year to a 10-year spread of years there.
Yeah.
So that way, if they don't need the income at that particular time, they can, what I call, defer the income.
Gotcha. And the benefit, folks, for those who are semi-familiar with the topic but not wholly familiar, The benefit to AFA, you might be asking, what's the benefit to AFA? The benefit to AFA is that when the annuitant passes away,
yes.
The remaining amount in the fund goes to AFA in the form of a donation. So
that's correct.
That's the long-term benefit to the ministry in doing these charitable gift annuities, but it's obviously mutually beneficial because this is great for folks that are planning for retirement and they want multiple streams of income beyond maybe Social Security or their Roth account. Maybe they want a third stream of income as well. And one more thing I'll add to this, which I say this every time I have Riley on, but it can't be said enough, is how strong the AFA Foundation annuity pool is. And I say that seriously because I'm not going to name names, or we don't have to compare ministries, but just broadly speaking, I would say it's if not the strongest, it's one of the strongest annuity pools in the country. And the reason that's important is because some foundations set up these annuity pools and then they end up using the annuity pool to fund their operations, which there's nothing wrong with that. And that's actually can be beneficial as long as you manage it well. But we're not doing that. Okay. So we're not dipping into this annuity pool to build things or fund things that are tertiary to the primary project. That is the CGA annuity pool.
We've been very blessed, Walker, for that, to not ever, like you mentioned, have to dip into the gift annuity pool to fund the
other things. Yeah, beyond the annuity payments. So
correct.
At some point, as it grows, just like an investment fund, we might end up dipping into it just because the money's there and the ministry might need it for ministry purposes. But right now, we're not doing that, and we haven't had to do that since its inception. So that's just one of the many points that we emphasize when talking to people about the AFA Foundation annuity. So, Riley, we got CGA. That's our kind of our most well-known product, most utilized. But there's a couple other ways that folks can partner with the AFA Foundation, such as including us in their wills.
Yes.
And a couple other products as well, but just mention maybe one or two of those.
Yes, so you mentioned that, including AFA and AFR in their will. They can do that. We get calls on a daily, weekly basis for that. As another reason or another way is a stock. You mentioned that. The stock donation, they can just give us a call and do an outright gift of stock to the ministry, as well as use a stock to fund a charitable gift annuity. A lot of people don't realize that. So with stock, stock, you can do an outright gift with that, or you can fund a charitable gift annuity. Another way is, you mentioned wills, another way is an IRA. You kind of briefly touched that, an IRA rollover to a charitable gift annuity. We have had a few people this past year and the beginning of this year of 2025 do that, because that has, I don't know all the logistics and how all of it works, but I do know that you have to be 70 and a half, and I believe it's a $50,000 one-time gift to American Family Association to fund the charitable gift annuity through a IRA rollover, and they receive a full 100% tax deduction for that. So
on the year that they do the rollover.
On the year they do the rollover. So that kind of helps them. It's a $50,000 gift to American Family Association, and they're receiving income off.
So that's
that.
The minimum you're saying.
That's
the minimum.
Yes.
So this is our CFO Walter. I think he walks the hallways and he just talks about to everybody about the IRA rollover.
Yes.
Because it is a great thing for people who have an IRA. But yeah, he's very big on this, and if we went this whole segment without talking about it, I think he would be pretty upset.
He would. That's why I had to throw that in there, Walter.
He might meet you in the hallway after the show.
Yes.
But he's right, because listen, folks, if you've got an IRA and you're looking for a way to not have to pay Uncle Sam as much money on your distributions, then you do the rollover. You do the IRA rollover into a charitable gift annuity. And what Riley's saying is you get the tax deduction on the year of the rollover. $50,000 is the minimum, but you get a tax deduction on that money, $50,000 or above, on the rollover. So you can turn it, you know, what's otherwise going to be taxed, you're going to turn it into a tax friendly environment by doing the rollover.
Yes, and I believe it's 70 and a half. It may be around 71, but you do have to meet certain requirements, for that to work.
Yeah, and when folks call in, when you call in to talk to Riley or any of the other team at the foundation, they've got all the tools needed to run all the formulas for you. So, for example, what's the minimum age? What's the minimum amount? All these hypotheticals out there, they have a system that we use that runs all that for you. And it knows all the tax code, all the tax laws, and what needs to be done. It also can give you, they give you projections out like, hey, if I do a CGA for this amount and I begin withdrawing it at this age, what's the amount going to be per month? All of that can be planned out. They can run all the formulas for you.
And that's also, Walker, on our website as well. If they don't want to give us a call, they can just go to afafoundation.net and click the calculator there and run an illustration as well.
Excellent. Illustration. That's the word I was looking for.
Yes, illustration. Gotcha.
All right, folks. Riley, how can folks call you or visit your website or maybe send you an email to find out more information?
Yes. So they can go to our website. Again, that's afafoundation.net. Again, that's afafoundation.net. Or give us a call here in the foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Excellent. Folks, I'm a little bit biased because I work here, but this really is, seriously, I'm not at retirement now, but as I get a little closer, maybe into my 40s or so, I'm going to do a charitable gift annuity just because it makes perfect sense. So the late Dan Celia, who worked with Riley and was on AFR for so many years, one thing he always talked about is having multiple streams of income during your retirement years. And any financial planner that you talk to will encourage you to do so. Not just rely on Social Security or not just rely on one retirement account, but having multiple streams of income into your retirement years is just wise financial advice that you'll get from many, many people. So, Riley, thanks so much for coming on, and appreciate y'all's work.
Thank you so much, Walker.
All right, folks. If you are planning to retire, which, Lord willing, at some point in our lives, we'll want to pass on the mantle of whatever our daily job is to someone else and maybe spend more time with the grandkids or invest in community service or spending time volunteering at your local church. Whatever your plans are in the years ahead, retirement needs to be a topic of discussion, and the AFA Foundation has all the tools needed to help you retire well. And not just retire, but leave a lasting legacy for your children and your grandchildren and for the ministry of American Family Association. AFAFoundation.net, that's the URL, AFAFoundation.net. We'll be back in a few.
And my father, your great-grandfather, fought in World War II.
Really?
He was a gunner on the big ship out in the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
Your great-grandmother did her part, too.
Was she on a ship?
Oh, no. She stayed back home. She and a lot of her friends worked really hard in a factory because the men had gone off to war.
Ooh.
And they held scrap metal drives to help in the war effort. The folks back home were heroes, too.
Here at the American Family Association, we consider you the heroes back home. As you fulfill your responsibility of caring for your family day to day, your partnership with us is crucial as we fight the enemies of freedom in America. Thank you for your commitment to the American Family Association.
Grandpa, what's a scrap metal drive?
Let's get some cookies, and I'll tell you all about it.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core. Walker Wildman here with you. In the last segment, we interviewed Riley Wildman, my sister, about her work over at the AFA Foundation. We try to bring Riley in, or a representative of the foundation, every few months or so to talk about their work and their offerings. So if you missed part of that interview or you just want more information, once again, their website is afafoundation.net, afafoundation.net. One other item before we jump to our next guest is the something I've been talking about for a couple months now, and that's our Activate Summit. It's going to be here before you know it. It's in June. It's our first ever Activate Summit, June 12th through the 14th. This summer are the dates, and we would love for you to join us. And this summit, what makes it special is that it syncs up with our latest and most in-depth that we've produced biblical worldview curriculum called the Activate Curriculum. And all of this is available for your perusal over at activate.afa.net, including the summit registration. But we're going to kick off with our first Activate Summit with the theme Biblical Bedrock, Building on the Authority of Scripture. So we're going to start at covering the basics, the foundation of our faith, and then each year we'll build upon, once again, the bedrock, and we'll elaborate on further topics that are of biblical significance. So it's going to be an excellent time. We hope to see many of you there. Please go over to activate.afa.net to find out more information and register. Once again, June 12th through the 14th are those dates, and we would love for you and the family to join us. Well, jumping to our next guest, Jason Sneed is with us. He's the executive director over at the Honest Elections Project Action, and he's with us now to talk about the topic of elections and integrity of elections. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Jason, this subject matter of elections and elections being run honestly and fairly has really been percolating in the media for the last, since the 2020 election and the fiasco that we witnessed during the 2020 election. Give us kind of a status of kind of a pulse check on where we are today, broadly speaking. I know we could talk about all 50 states and federal, but just give us kind of an overall picture of where we are today as far as how our elections are run and whether they're being run well or maybe not.
Well, I think that that's actually a pretty difficult question to give a single answer to, because as you noted, we've got 50 states, we've got Congress, we've got lots of variation. And so my answer to that question largely depends on where you live. You know, if you live in a conservative state like Texas or Florida, then your elections are running better than they ever have before. In fact, Florida, you know, my organization and others have held out as a national model for how to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat, and how to deliver election results on election night. But if you live in a blue area like California, they're not only still struggling to get elections right, they're actually making it harder to get election results anywhere close to election night. In fact, we remember this year, it took weeks to figure out who was going to win some of those final House races. It was weeks before we knew who was going to actually control Congress. So if you live in red areas right now, if you live in conservative areas, they've passed hundreds of laws that have taken the slack out of our election systems, made those systems more secure, and done a lot of work to improve our elections. But unfortunately, there are a lot of states, including some states that are going to decide future presidential elections like Pennsylvania, that still have quite a lot of work left to do.
Before we move on to election initiatives, which is a major tool of the left now over the last 24 months, what is the deal? I mean, we could go like uber cynical and say that they like cheating, talking about people who resist any election reforms. But if we want to try to treat it more seriously than just the cynical side of it, what's the deal with these elections in these various states? Let's talk about Pennsylvania if we need to be specific here. What's the deal with these elections that are run so sloppily? They're run so sloppy, they're run so, you know, loose that there's people on the voter rolls that shouldn't be. There's not proper chain of custody. I mean, there's a litany of all kinds of issues. Voter ID, they just balk at the idea of voter ID. What's going on here?
Yeah, you know, that voter ID piece is a really interesting one, and we can just start with that. You know, we look at poll after poll. My group has actually done some polling nationally. You're looking at almost 90% of the American public that says you should have to show a photo ID before you can cast a ballot in an election. It's a very common sense position that almost everybody agrees with, except for the very small sliver of the population that basically runs the Democratic Party and is completely bought in on this argument, which is rejected by almost everybody else, that something as basic as a voter ID law is actually voter suppression. What you're really seeing here is that there is an entire partisan apparatus that is set up that wants to win elections using a form of machine politics, where they want everybody to be automatically registered. They want everybody to get a mail ballot. They want party operatives to be able to go door to door and do what they call vote harvesting, right? Collecting ballots from those people. Basically, they want to take the voter out of the equation and just let a party machine decide who's going to vote and who they're going to vote for. And so all of these election integrity rules they see as sand in the gears of what they hope is a well-oiled machine. Things like cleaning up voter rolls, basic requirements like you should actually register if you want to participate in our elections, showing an ID, and protections against vote harvesting, which are designed, after all, to make sure that your vote is not entrusted in the hands of somebody who maybe thinks you should have voted the other way. So they want to get rid of all of those rules so they can roll out this Chicago-style machine and basically reduce voting to just who can get the most ballots mailed out and then go out and collect the most ballots. That's what you're really seeing. It's not so much that they want to win through cheating, but they're certainly more than prepared to turn a blind eye to clear vulnerabilities that are and have been exploited in our elections in order to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, and the examples of this, you know, some people push back and say, oh, there's no examples of voter fraud. Show me an example. There actually are. And I know you guys are experts in this, but if you do your homework, you can find, you can actually find election officials that are criminally charged nearly every election cycle somewhere in the country because things are not being done properly. And there's intentional malfeasance around this area of elections. So there are actually examples of criminality involved with our elections. You just have to look and find the right stories. Let me ask you this, Jason. Let's jump to ballot initiatives or the ballot amendments that have been, this has been a tool used, at least I know for sure, over the last maybe 20 or 30 years, the conservatives have used it on occasion to raise awareness and get, you know, different constitutional amendments on the ballot. For example, pro-life amendments or marriage amendments, you know, over the last 10 to 20 years. But talk about how this thing has like morphed into a tool of the globalist, a tool of the Marxists, and how it's beginning to backfire, if you will, against conservatives.
Yeah, so what we're talking about is ballot measures, you know, constitutional amendments or referenda that appear on the ballot whenever we go to vote. And what we have seen historically, you're absolutely right. There have been instances where conservatives have been able to use these processes to get some good policies passed. But over the last 10 to 15 years, the left has really weaponized these processes. And they're using them as an end run around the democratic process itself, right? I mean, we have a Republican form of government. That is, we elect people to go serve in the legislature, and those lawmakers then write our laws, right? That's the way the process is supposed to be. But what the left has figured out is that when those legislatures don't buy what the left is selling or don't want to give the left 100% of what they want, because we know the legislative process, you're very lucky to get 10 or 20% of what you want through that process, then they can just go to the ballot measure, they can write an initiative, they can get the signatures, they can put millions of dollars into a highly effective PR campaign, and they can convince voters to enshrine the left-wing kind of progressive agenda into the Constitution when the legislature said no. And we've seen this rolled out all over the country with measures that are designed to do everything from enshrining an unrestricted abortion rights into the Constitution to rewriting the rules of the democratic process itself, all designed to help the left win elections. And they're also using these ballot measures to influence candidate races too. And one of the really insidious pieces of this is that part of this process of weaponizing ballot measures has also seen the influx of foreign money. The left is not only using ballot measures to push their agenda into our state constitutions, they're also using money tied to at least one foreign billionaire to get it done all over the country. And we think that's something that should be banned.
Yeah, that's where I want to pivot in the last 4 or 5 minutes we have left, is where to go from here. Because, you know, I didn't think we would get to this point where globalists and ideological Marxists are using this ballot initiative process in a very nefarious way to actually thwart the will of the people when you look at it. Because if the elected representatives are not wanting to move on an issue, it's because there's not a groundswell of support behind said issue. And then the means of harvesting a lot of these signatures for these ballot initiatives is very shady. I know there was some criminal cases in Florida where they were doing nefarious things on collecting signatures. But where do we go from here? Because some say we just need to throw this whole thing out. We just need to throw this whole ballot initiative process out because there's more harm than good coming from it. What say you?
Well, I think that there is a lot of merit to the argument that this process has been abused, that this process has been weaponized. It's supposed to be, in its best form, a final check of the citizenry on the government. Instead, it is being used to do an end run around the democratic process, and it is being misused to push a very partisan agenda into state constitutions and then essentially prevent the people from electing legislatures that can ever undo that. So I do think that there should be some reforms considered, because you're absolutely right. Look at what happened in Florida, where it certainly appears, based on an investigation by the Florida Election Crimes Office, that there was fraud in that process, a process that ultimately led to well over $100 million being spent in Florida just on one ballot measure alone. One of the things that we think states should do is take this opportunity right now, though, to address the key loophole that I mentioned earlier that's allowing foreign nationals to pump money into these elections. You know, there is a federal law that says foreign nationals cannot contribute to candidates, but federal law does not consider a ballot measure campaign to be an election, and so that ban does not apply. And what we've actually seen is that one of the largest left-wing groups in the country that finances these measures, a group called the 1630 Fund, has spent $130 million in 25 states, while they have taken nearly $300 million from a Swiss billionaire named Hans-Jörg Wiese. So they are hoovering up money from this foreign national, and then they are turning around and they are spending hand over fist to try to pump left-wing ballot measures into our states. States can ban that, and I'm very pleased that Ohio did last year, and now we've got legislation moving in 12 states to do just that.
We're talking to Jason Sneed, Executive Director of the Honest Elections Project, or Honest Election Project Action, both of those entities. Jason, on your website, you actually have model legislation that is aimed at banning foreign funding for ballot measures. I know you just alluded to it, but talk a little bit more about that and how easily state lawmakers can take up this model legislation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we do have a model on the Honest Elections Project website. That's honestelections.org for anybody that wants to go check that out. It's a very simple law that basically brings parity and equality between the law governing candidate elections, which, as I said, foreign nationals cannot give to people running for office, and what they can do in the context of ballot measures. And so it basically does a few different things. First, it bans direct and indirect contributions from foreign nationals, and we've designed our ban so that groups like the 1630 Fund can't take up large amounts of money from foreign nationals and claim that they're only spending it on other projects, which is, of course, is going to be a scheme so that they can free up resources from American donors to then spend on ballot measures. So we try to prevent that kind of money laundering aspect of this as well. We ban this for independent expenditures too, so that we don't inadvertently create a loophole where a foreign national could just go spend on an independent expenditure or a quote unquote dark money campaign instead of giving to one of these measures. And we make sure that there is a process here so that this is not going to be weaponized and abused against Americans that are trying to express their First Amendment protection. So we're protective of donor privacy as well, because we want to make sure that we're protecting the democratic process, not allowing this to become an excuse to go after American donors. So if you put that ban into effect, then you can do what Ohio did. They actually succeeded in getting that group, the 1630 Fund, to stop spending last year in their state after they had poured millions of dollars into ballot measures in Ohio. And I'm very pleased again to see 12 states are pushing this legislation forward. We hope to get it done in many places before we can have another election tainted with foreign influence.
Yeah, this is why I want to emphasize the important work at the state level, even while Washington, D.C., thankfully, is captured by conservatives, at least in the executive branch and the judicial branch. We can't forget what needs to happen at the state level during this time. We can't kind of go to sleep at the wheel when it comes to state policy because we have a friend in the White House. We've got to be doing all things at once, and that includes advancing good legislation at the state level. Jason Sneed, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, appreciate that. That's Jason Sneed. His URL, by the way, is Honest Elections, plural, honestelections.org, honestelections.org, and you can read all about their work and check out that model legislation that I was mentioning. And the ballot initiative process, folks, as Jason said, it's become tainted, and it's basically become a primary tool of the Marxist and the globalist. And Florida marijuana is one example, but there's other examples as well, including the radical pro-abortion amendments that they're passing around the country. So we need to take a fresh look at the whole ballot initiative process. And if it can't be fixed, we just got to throw it out. That's a fact. And if we want stuff done, well, we can contact our state lawmaker and our governor, and they can pass legislation. That's how a representative democracy works. This ballot initiative process has been poisoned, and for that reason, there's a lot of reputable people that say we just need to throw the whole thing out and work through our lawmakers and our elected representatives. We'll be back in a few. Meet Kelsey. When she found out she was pregnant, she wasn't sure where to turn. But after meeting with the counselors at a preborn network clinic who loved and supported her, and after hearing her baby's heartbeat on a free ultrasound, she chose Life.
When a mother looks at her child through a sonogram, it does something to you. You know, I ended up deciding to keep my son, who is now 5 years old today. He's amazing. He brings absolute joy to my heart. I could not imagine life without him. Not only did they help me save his life, they saved my life.
By introducing a woman to her baby on ultrasound, a baby's chance of life doubles. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 will sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, helping to rescue 200 babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 on your phone, and then say the keyword baby. Or you can donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to be with you this last segment of the program. If you want to watch the show, well, we're live streaming on Facebook. Go to At The Core's Facebook page and you can watch the show each day live. Also, stream.afa.net is the AFA stream platform where you can watch most of the shows that you hear on the daily lineup. You can watch there live and archives. We've also got excellent documentaries and various video series there at stream.afa.net. So go there and check it out. On Friday, I actually did a live show on Friday, which I don't usually do, and we talked all things Ukraine-US and the disaster of an Oval Office meeting that took place on Friday. I was watching it nearly live, and I was just baffled that the whole thing fell apart. And we knew the negotiations were rocky from the onset because there were various media reports that were actually contradictory. And Zelensky kept, you know, running his mouth with the media leading up to the deal being signed. It was very, very sketchy and unproductive just from an outsider's perspective that the two parties, specifically the Ukrainian delegation, they kept contradicting the White House, and which is very unusual in these type of negotiations. But so we talked about this on Friday, and we're going to pick it up today. What I want folks to understand, as far as looking at the perspective of maybe President Trump or the White House, or even my perspective on this, is at this point in the war between Russia and Ukraine, regurgitating the same talking points or the same facts surrounding the situation are not really helpful in negotiating peace or even negotiating a ceasefire or, in this case, negotiating an economic partnership. Now, it might make you feel better, right, to regurgitate the same facts. It might make you feel better. It's almost a form of therapy. But it's not really helpful as you're trying to negotiate between two parties that viciously hate each other. And I'm talking about the Russian president and the Ukrainian president. So, and I only say that because that seemed to be Zelensky's go-to. As you watch the 45-minute back and forth in the Oval Office, which unfortunately a lot of the media didn't show the entire context. A lot of the media just showed a 5-minute clip of Vance and Zelensky going back and forth. But when you actually watch the entire thing, of which I did, there was 30 minutes of cordial conversation leading up to really the breakdown in negotiations and communication in the Oval Office. And it broke down because Zelensky decided that it was a great idea to challenge the vice president and begin being combative with him in the Oval Office live on television, which was where the whole breakdown occurred if you watch the clip or if you watch the full thing. But Zelensky kept kind of regurgitating the same talking points that Ukraine has from day one. And it's not that his talking points were factually inaccurate. It was that when you're at a place where it's time to negotiate, and President Trump has made it abundantly clear that he wants peace here, he wants a ceasefire at a minimum, then you can't go into negotiations with the kind of the leader of the party, if you will, meaning President Trump, and just keep saying the same old talking points. That's a waste of everyone's time. So, for example, when Zelensky calls, you know, Putin a bad guy, says that he doesn't uphold his end of the bargain, I'm paraphrasing, and there will, quote, never be a ceasefire, that was Zelensky's words. Those are very unfruitful, unhelpful statements to be making when President Trump is trying to mediate some type of peace deal here. And I also want everyone to remember that kind of the, if you looked at this from a phased approach, the first phase of any type of peace deal or even a ceasefire without maybe not even a long-term peace deal, but just simply a, hey, let's stop firing the bullets. The first phase of this, from the President Trump's perspective, was the economic partnership, okay? And there's a couple reasons for this, but let me just give kind of the U.S. side of this and then the Ukrainian side. The U.S. advantage is that we recoup our money that we've spent, $300+ billion, funding the Ukraine war, okay? And we can get into a spat about should we have funded it to begin with or not, and at this point that's irrelevant, although it would make for a good conversation. but nonetheless, here we are, right? We're 3 years later, we've got a new president in the Oval Office, and we've spent $300 billion on Ukraine, all right? That's where we are today. maybe we wish we weren't here, but that's where we are, okay? So it's a waste of time to regurgitate the same old talking points about how we shouldn't have gotten to this place to begin with, all right? Because we are here. That's the U.S. advantage, all right? That's the lens in which President Trump and his team are looking at this is, hey, this is an opportunity to recoup the money that we've spent on the war. Simultaneously, you ask, well, what's the benefit for Ukraine, or is this just all about the U.S. getting their bucks back? Well, no, folks, that's not all that this is about, okay? In order for the U.S. to enter an economic partnership on the rare earth minerals with Ukraine, that is a boon in the side of Ukraine. This is very positive for Ukraine, okay? No matter how the left spins it, no matter how CNN spins it, or the Democrats, this economic mineral deal is a major step forward for Ukraine. And we can't miss that. Because if we miss that, then we go, well, this is just about Trump trying to get our money back. Well, okay, that's part of it, which is actually a noble cause to begin with. But there's more to it than that. And if we miss it, then we're either naive, not properly informed, or we're regurgitating the talking points of the left. But this mineral deal is a big benefit to Ukraine. And here's why. There's two reasons why. Number one, this immediately brings U.S. money and U.S. assets and U.S. innovation into Ukraine. We're talking about American companies on the ground in Ukraine, possibly in the disputed region of Ukraine where Russian troops are, okay? So it brings a lot of American interest to Ukraine. It brings a lot of American innovation to Ukraine, which in turn boost their economy, all right? So that's the economic side of it. But Zelensky kept talking about security guarantees. Security guarantees. Well, okay, let's talk about security guarantees. If you've got American assets on the ground in Ukraine, of which there's actually American assets there now, the government, but if you talk about American companies in Ukraine, rare earth mineral companies on the ground in Ukraine, do you think that Vladimir Putin's going to drop a bomb and blow up 12 American businessmen in Ukraine? No, he's not. That would be a dumb move. So by forming this economic partnership, by Ukraine entering into this mineral deal with the U.S., not only are you guaranteeing a decades-long economic partnership where there's shared interest in the security of Ukraine, but you're also putting American lives on the ground in Ukraine, at which in and of itself is a form of a security guarantee. The last thing Russia wants to do is to kill an American citizen in this conflict with Ukraine. All right. And then thirdly, even though I mentioned two things, thirdly, and probably most importantly, this paves the way for a peace deal. This paves the way for a security guarantee. And it's so mind-boggling to me that me, Walker, as a radio show commentator, can figure this thing out, and most of you can too, but Ukraine seems to be completely oblivious to the advantages for Ukraine of this rare earth mineral deal. And so the third thing, and the most important in my opinion, is this establishes capital and credibility with the President of the United States. This gives President Trump an economic and a political victory on the homeland that paves the way for having his ear in future negotiations. It builds credibility with the chief negotiating party. Don't you understand? It's like a real estate agent. It's like insulting the real estate agent in a real estate deal. It doesn't make sense to insult the chief negotiator in this dispute. But that's exactly what Zelensky did. And then the last thing I'll say on this before we play a clip before the end of the show is I'm very skeptical of Zelensky, okay? We know that Ukraine was, and there's no evidence that this has changed. We know that Ukraine was notoriously corrupt before this war. All right, Ukraine was like a top-ranked corrupt nation. As far as all developed nations, they were up at the top as far as being the most corrupt. Massive Ponzi schemes, massive money laundering, massive kickbacks fraud in Ukraine before the war. All right, so that was an established fact. Ukraine's reputation on the world stage was one of mass corruption, all right, before 2022, before the war began. And there's no evidence that that has changed, all right? So with that being the established context before the war, and there's billions of dollars going into there, I'm very skeptical of Zelensky, okay? I'm very skeptical of Zelensky. And after that fiasco of an Oval Office meeting where he absolutely acted a fool, I'm even more skeptical of Zelensky. Like, I'm totally turned off by it. I don't even want Trump to do a deal with him because of how shady he acted in the Oval Office. But I think it's possible, I'm just theorizing here, it's possible the whole thing was a setup. And not how you think it is. Not that J.D. Vance and Trump set Zelensky up for a disaster of an Oval Office meeting. I don't think that's the case. I think it's possible, and time will bear this out if it's true, I think it's possible Zelensky never intended to sign the deal when he went into the Oval Office. And the only reason I would dare to say that is because how do you travel all the way across the ocean and get to the point where you're in the Oval Office in front of the world? And you let the whole thing fall apart? Like, we're not talking rookies here, okay? We're not talking rookies. We're not talking amateurs, all right? Between Zelensky's team and the Trump team, these guys have been doing this a long time. And you want me to believe that Zelensky got into the Oval Office and just completely lost emotional control over the situation? Completely lost control over the negotiating position of Ukraine in the Oval Office? That's a hard pill to swallow, and that's a hard kind of deal to pitch. And so I'm just having a really hard time that Zelensky was intending to sign the mineral earth deal, the rare earth mineral deal, and then all of a sudden he got into the Oval Office and had a change of heart and wanted to completely act a fool and interrupt the president, challenge the vice president publicly. I just have a really hard time believing that just organically transpired and that Zelensky lost all emotional control in the Oval Office and began basically arguing like a teenager. Maybe that happened. Maybe he was going to sign the deal and then he got into the Oval Office and just didn't like what President Trump or J.D. Vance was saying. That's very possible. But it's kind of hard to believe because a lot of these things are really ironed out before the cameras and everything. And the whole thing just absolutely fell apart. So I was going to play a clip. I'm not going to play it now because we don't have time. I'll play it later in the week. But the latest on this is that Zelensky actually left the White House. He was reportedly told to leave by President Trump and his team. And remember, one thing to add to this as we begin to build the whole, story behind how this transpired, there are multiple reports that Secretary of State Marco Rubio had been in negotiations with Zelensky and his team, and that this was all agreed upon. I mean the deal was like basically as close to being set in stone as any deal could be. I mean, it was just a matter of the Oval Office meeting, you know, lunch at the White House, and then a signing ceremony. I mean, the parties had both gotten on the same page, and they had been negotiating this for a matter of weeks. And so there are reports that Secretary of State Rubio was really taken back by Zelensky's behavior in the Oval Office because he was convinced that this was a done deal. Even convinced by Zelensky that this whole thing was a done deal. And then he gets into the Oval Office and gets combative with the president and the vice president. So pretty surprising there, but time will tell what's going to take place here. But President Trump, look, he's an open book, and he campaigned on this. He wants peace. He doesn't want more killing in Russia and Ukraine. All right? And that's not praising Zelensky or praising Putin. He's just saying, I want the bullets to stop flying because I told Americans that that's what I would do.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.